downloading the Demimonde podcast. We are discussing the Showtime series Penny Dreadful. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Sam.
And I'm your host, Steve.
And just so you know, the best way to support us, if you want to let us know that you want us to keep producing these podcasts, is just to head over to iTunes and write us a review. If you're shy about writing reviews, you can click on some stars. If you're going to click one star, give us a reason. Don't wuss out.
Yeah. Follow through.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to give you 5 out of 5 anuses.
That's right. We have our own rating system.
Yes. You don't want 5 out of 5 anuses.
You really don't even want 4 out of 5, but whatever.
And these are not good anuses. Another way to support us, you can go to our website, go to our contact page. We have a Facebook, we have a Twitter, and we also have a Gmail account, and you can write to any of these. We love to share feedback on our podcast, which you'll hear at the end of this episode.
We're definitely a feedback-friendly podcast. We really like to involve everybody who listens to us in the conversation about what's going on the show. We think it really makes it fun and interesting. And we also have an Amazon link. So this is one good way to support us. Just go to our homepage at noship.net, click on the Amazon link, and it takes you directly to the Amazon homepage where you can do your shopping like normal. And it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a little bit of kickback for crosses and holy water and things like that.
Yes, because we're evil. Wait, no, that means we're good.
Yeah, we're fighting evil.
Oh, what?
Come on.
All right, so before we get started into the recap, do you have any thoughts on this episode?
The temporizing is over and season 2 is here. This episode did not disappoint, as I knew that it wouldn't. And I have a feeling that this whole season is not going to disappoint. I think we're in for something really special.
Yeah, it's like we haven't missed a beat. I don't think very much time has passed, maybe just a couple of days.
Yeah, that's it. It seems like the time lapse is gone. And they give you a pretty solid idea of that right from the get-go. So you're not left with a whole lot of guesswork, you know, with Ethan being found at the Mariner's Inn and stuff like that. And you don't have to sit there and kind of go, wait a minute, how much time has actually passed?
Well, in his case, it only has to be overnight.
Yeah,
unless
true.
He slept for days there.
So it could literally be just the next day.
Yeah.
You know, after the events of the closing of last season, mm-hmm. Which is cool because a lot of times you know, shows go away and then they come back and there's this indeterminate amount of time that's passed and you have to try to piece it together. And sometimes I don't even really feel like the writers have a real grasp on how much time. They don't want to be held down to anything. That way, if they want to say, well, this and this happened since the last time you caught up with us, they can do that and get away with it.
All right, let's go ahead and get into recap. We are discussing Penny Dreadful, Season 2, Episode 1, which is titled Fresh Hell. It's directed by James Hawes and written by John Logan.
That's a badass name for an episode,
Fresh Hell. Yeah.
I've got a fresh pack of hell. Want a piece?
I got some fresh hot hell right here. You want some?
Hot hell, fresh off the presses. We've got fresh hell, fresh, never frozen.
I'm fresh out of hell over here. The episode opens with a bird's eye view of Vanessa Ives walking through the snow in a park. It is daytime, and there are many families enjoying this park despite the chill weather. We see Madame Collie, also known as Evelyn Poole, watching Ives from a short distance, and she begins to chant in an unknown language to us at this time, but we now know it as Verbis Diablo. This chant brings Ives down onto her knees, and she appears to be suffering or in some sort of torment. She gestures to a couple to stay back, and I'm assuming it's for their own protection.
Mm-hmm.
Evelyn Poole continues to watch Ives as she begins to recover, it seems, and then we cut to opening credits.
Two things about this scene. First of all, anytime you do that to Vanessa Ives, you're going to regret it. You're going to live to regret it. Secondly, when did Evelyn Poole / Madame Kali become such a badass? You know, at what point, what did we miss? This is really the enigma that's going to unfold over this season, I think, because we're going to learn the backstory of her character. Has she always been this way? Did something happen during the seance? There hasn't been a huge time lapse like we've already determined between the seasons, just a day or two. So it's not something that happened during that interim. So it's always been there, whatever it is. But what is it?
She the Saruman of this...
Yeah. Make you think she's good and then she's really bad.
Yep. I think we saw the tip of the iceberg with her during the seance episode. She definitely had some powers because she was able to detect something inside of Ives at the time before it manifested.
True. Yeah.
So there was that. And I think I had supposed that she was a practitioner in spiritualism at the time. But, you know, maybe not as, and I didn't even know what Ives was at the time when we watched that episode. I thought she was a spiritualist and just stronger. And I thought she was carrying a force around willingly.
Which we've since found to be
Not the case.
not the truth, yeah.
Yeah. And then we saw Evelyn Poole at the in the last episode, I believe, of last season, where she had that Cheshire cat grin and was clearly, asking questions about Ives, but acting like she was flirting with Malcolm
You're talking
Murray.
about when Eminem was buying the gun? Yeah, okay.
So, and we learned that she was up to no good at that point, that she was going to be brought back, I think, just by her actions there. But yeah, she's much more of a badass than we would have ever expected based on those two encounters from season one. Okay, so then we cut, like I said, to opening credits. There's no changes in the in there that I can see. So now we get some answers about Ethan that we're wanting, actually not the ones we wanted. He awakens in the inn. He is still where we last saw him, and it's revealed to us that he indeed killed more than just the men who were trying to take him back to the States, back to his father. He is obviously shaken as he surveys the aftermath of his wrath.
Yeah, he's shaken. But and it's unfortunate that he killed innocent people. You know
If
that.
he indeed did, because we'll talk about this when we get to the
Oh, okay.
investigator.
Yeah. Your idea about the survivor and stuff. Okay, good. All right, fair enough.
But yeah, it's at this point you would think that he did all of it. So now next we have Ives arriving home at dusk when Ethan intercepts her, saying he needs to talk to her.
Now, he doesn't want to talk in the house.
No.
Is that because he doesn't? I mean, Sambeni, I mean, they can. He's going to give them privacy, I would imagine. Even though he does hear an awful lot that he doesn't seem like was directed at him.
Yeah, he does seem to hear a lot,
So
awful
maybe
lot.
that's why. Or do you think it's because of what happened in the house? Maybe he feels a little uneasy there, which doesn't necessarily jive with the fact that he decides to stay there later on. But he does that for her benefit, not for his own.
I think he decides to talk to her alone because they've already started to establish a connection because
Yeah.
he's the one who freed her, or helped her suppress the demon inside her. Also, he feels a kinship with her because they both carry around a darkness.
It's also a good scene for the two characters to talk about that because they're inside of this small enclosed area, so there's a forced intimacy between the two of them anyway because of that. So it was a good idea.
Yeah, and they're also vulnerable at the same time to attack, as we see.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, he's telling her how he's gonna leave. He wants to leave. He may go to Spain or Russia to join a war because that's what he's good at, is fighting. She asks him, how can he leave when all they have won is a small battle and a larger war that they're waging? He is actually more worried about the war inside themselves, and she's like, you mean inside me? And he says, no, both of us, that they both.
Yeah.
And this is where he starts to confess about his blackouts and that there's sometimes blood, or there's usually blood. And Ives asks, how can she help? He says, you cannot change who you are or who you love.
Ooh.
There's almost a pause after that, and I feel like that's directed at her,
Yeah.
not Brona.
No, I don't think so.
And the carriage is then suddenly jostled. They are being attacked by these hairless, naked women who are screeching like banshees.
I mistook them for vampires when I first saw them.
I don't think I even really thought much about it. I was just, there was like a lot of, I was kind of annoyed with the jump scares.
Yeah, it's a very, very overused thing in a lot of modern horror films. It was effective when it first came out, however many years ago, but now it's kind of passé, and so I was a little bit disappointed in Penny Dreadful to see this in the show. Not really, not that bad. It's just it's taken the scare effect away. I think it's the shine is off of that special effect.
So the carriage is flipped onto its side, and there seems to be some calm for a short period. And then Ethan and Ives begin to right themselves when one of these witches that we know now are witches confronts Ives from above. And this witch is saying something in another language, and then Ives counters back in the same language with some,
Some venom.
serious venom. And this frightens the witch. Very
I found the
afraid.
translation online for that language, what Vanessa Ives was saying, and basically said scram. So that's what she did. Now, whatever Ives was saying wasn't coming from Ives. It was coming from the demon that's inside her. And it was speaking to this other demon, and it was just saying, get the fuck out of my face, before I twist your head off, kind of thing. And the other witch was just like, oh shit, and I'm out of here.
Yeah, whatever's inside Ives surfaced for that moment and then just spoke that language and had more of a grasp on the language than the witch herself, it seems like. So yes, like you said, the witch flees and Ethan and Ives help each other out of the cab. They see that the driver and the horses are dead. And then we, as viewers, see the witches watching from afar, and they seem to, and there's three of them, and they seem to effortlessly summon clothes onto their bodies from the air. And this is like probably where you're really going, who are these? What are these?
The bitches of Eastwick.
So now our attention is taken to Dr. Frankenstein and Caliban. They are standing near Brona's body, which is laid out on a gurney, which is hoisted up by a pulley mechanism. Caliban asks, will she remember? And Dr. Frankenstein says he does not know because her life was benighted. And benighted means overcame by darkness. And this is why Caliban says that they will seek the shadows together in his usual eloquence.
He does have really eloquent way of speaking. It's always a pleasure to hear him say his lines. You know, when he says thee and me, it's just like it's like someone's massaging your brain, but not putting you to sleep. You know what I mean? Not like the kind of relaxing massage. It's almost like it's perking it up. It's hard to explain. But he makes a lot of assumptions here. I mean, he makes the assumption that just because she wakes up and she's kind of a creature akin to him, that she's going to want to hang out. And moreover, she's going to want to hang out in the shadows.
He's kind of possessive of her, don't you think?
Already.
Yeah.
Already. I mean, he's jumping the gun big time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's going to be in for a rude awakening there.
Mm-hmm. Because I have a feeling how this is going to go, and it's not going to go that way. But I'll explain that later. I have my own little pet theory about stuff.
Dr. Frankenstein commands Caliban to lower her, and he does so. And she is immersed in some fluid, which I think is more than just water. It's probably like electrolyte rich and has some other preservatives, but the electrolytes would make it more conductive. Dr. Frankenstein says now that they'll wait on the weather, and Caliban prepares to leave to find work. And then he tells Frankenstein that he will never be far from him, almost as a warning, right?
Yeah, it does sound like a warning.
And then Frankenstein asks, well, after, I sealed the deal with Brona here, you're going to leave, right? Leave me alone? And Caliban says, no.
You know what this reminds me of? Crichton and Scorpius.
Oh, yeah. Harvey.
If you've ever watched Farscape, it reminds me of John Crichton and Scorpius. It's just like, all right, if I give you this wormhole information, are you going to fuck off finally? And it's just like, yeah, but no.
They have to have their Superman fight in the dumpster. So, yeah, Caliban says, he brings up the thee and me and says we are bound together.
That's creepy. I wouldn't want that guy telling me that we're bound together.
It's like I have mixed emotions about Caliban.
Yeah.
They'll come out as we talk. But
I mean, I'm never going to forget that he killed Van Helsing like that. And that was horrible because Van Helsing was such a cool guy. But then at the same time, you do feel sorry for him at times. And you're just, you feel this kind of sympathy for the guy because of the way, Rory Kinnear is such a great actor. And he doesn't, when he speaks, but he doesn't even need to speak. Just the way his facial expressions are, it elicits sympathy out of the viewer.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Other times you just want to like run or smash his head in, one of the two.
So now at the Murray estate, Ives sits before the fire, still in fear's grasp. Ethan explains what they encountered to Sembene, and then Ethan approaches Ives and asks her to speak with him. He asks, what were they? And she does not answer him, and this frustrates him, and she tells him to leave London as he has planned.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that she knows what these witches are through experience with them in some sort of chapter in her life that we haven't seen that started pre-season one? Is that what you think?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. She gets up and walks away from him. And Sembene has been watching this conversation the whole time. And then Ethan walks over to Sembene and he says he'll be back tomorrow when Malcolm gets back home. And Ethan leaves. Then Sembene walks over to Ives and puts a cloak over her. And Ives asks Sembene if he thinks that the past can return. And he says it never leaves them. It is who they are. And she says, God help us then.
Yeah, the past never leaves us. That's a shitty thing to hear when you're in a state like that. Because she's trying desperately to get away from her past and not to have its grasp on her back all the time. And he's like going, not only can you not escape it, it's almost a step ahead of you. You're never going to surpass it.
He's not ever going to sugarcoat anything. I mean, this is the guy who bitch slaps and cat kills.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said this, when he says it never leaves them, it is who they are, there's this look on his face that lets me know we're going to learn more about Senbene this season.
I think so. I think you're right. I have faith that the writers are going to deliver on that. Because we got little glimpses, tiny little glimpses of who he was and who he's about in last season, and now they're going to make good on that. They have to. He's too cool of a character to just have him be who he's been so far, even though he's been pretty fucking cool at times. You know, there just needs to be more. I want to know about Senbene.
So next is a short scene of Ethan standing outside of the Murray estate, looking lonely, staring up in the snow. And he walks over and stands over to an adjacent building of some sort. And he gets comfortable, like he's going to stand guard all night, as if he's Ives watchdog.
Like, yeah, I was going to say, like a faithful dog. Mm-hmm.
So now Malcolm is at his country estate with his wife, and they stand before Mina's tombstone. And Mrs. Murray is grieving over a loss of another child. She blames him clearly and wants no more to do with him. They will stay married but not live together. And then she tells him they have no more children for him to save or to kill.
And he is shaken.
Yeah.
But not stirred. I was saving that one.
Well, you used it last season, but you're not above
I recycle jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very environmentally conscious with my jokes.
Very.
You know, she blames him from the son for the death of the son, which is rightfully so. He shouldn't have taken that kid to Africa. You know what I mean? That kid couldn't have done a field trip to London by himself. It's kind of a little panty waste. But as far as Mina, I don't know. That's Ives' fault pretty much altogether. So, I mean, okay, maybe we can't blame it all on her, but she started that ball rolling, we'll say. But at any rate, they're going to stay married on paper, and I guess this is pretty much her bowing out, saying, all right, see you later.
Yeah, she hates him.
Yeah. He was offering to stay with her and have a life because they were happy at once, and he's acting like nothing's going on in London, everything's taken care of, and all this other stuff, but he would have never been happy out there in the country. He would have hung out for a few weeks, you know, rested up, and then he would have been like, I need to go do something.
Well, I think we're going to find out, like, you know, this last season with Mina, that's had some impact on him. So he's probably trying to find a way to soothe whatever wounds he has, like soul wounds or whatever, regarding all that. And maybe that's why he's reaching out to his wife. Just the last vestige of his children. But anyway, so now, Malcolm starts to head home to London. Caliban walks the streets of London looking for work. There's not many prospects out there. He's not the only one in this predicament because he sees a vagrant child on the streets. He then discovers a waxwork parlor with a help wanted sign. Caliban then enters and sees some amazing waxworks as he walks through the place. And then he follows the sound of someone whistling, where he stumbles upon Mr. Putney, who is the owner of the parlor. There is work, but not much pay if Caliban is willing. But first, Caliban needs to meet the family. Mr. Putney gives Caliban a tour. He is working on a new idea of recreating famous murders from the papers. He has Jack the Ripper represented and a new one that is in the works, which is called the Mariners Inn Massacre.
Dun, dun, dun.
And it looks very familiar.
This wax shit is just awesome. Mm-hmm. I can't say enough about it. I need to go to a wax museum and just spend all day in there because it creeps me out, but I'm drawn to it. At the same time, it's like watching a scary movie or a scary TV show, I guess. But it's repulsive but attractive at the same time. You know, I would probably just stand there and stare at it waiting for it to blink. You know?
Well, the impressive detail is what's attractive about it, but the fact that it's so still. Because I have a coworker who creates wax sculptures of newborn babies, and they look realistic, but they're scary. And
Does she sell them? Or is
she does. Wow. Online.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's even creepier. Get your wax baby online. Who collects that shit?
I don't know.
if anybody out there listening to that collects that kind of stuff, write us in and let us know what the appeal is. I'd be interested.
After you said who collects that shit.
Exactly. Well, then you'd be letting me know who collects that shit, and we could open up a dialogue about it. That's how this works.
Okay. Yeah, so like I said, he's got one called that he's working on called the Mariners Inn Massacre. And this transitions to the actual crime scene where there's an investigator who goes by the name of Bartholomew Rusk. He's Investigator Rusk.
And this guy's a little bit he's on the ball, at least compared to the last investigator that we had last season, who was just kind of like, yeah, well, it could be over here, it could be over there, it might be somewhere.
Well, we learn here that, first of all, the property owner is in a hurry to get this whole thing wrapped up because he wants to sell it so that they can turn it into tenement buildings, which
Right.
causes the investigator, he's lamenting the loss of wood structures that are being paved over with brick, basically, which is surprising because even though this is what, 1891, the Great London Fire was in 1666, and it had a lot to do with wooden buildings everywhere. And you would think that, maybe wood's not all that great,
Yeah,
but.
but it's also kind of archaic in another way because, you know, now people kind of lament the fact that there's not enough brick around. You know,
I know,
it's
I thought
some,
about
you
that.
know, it's some other building material, or it's these big sky rises,
Yeah.
or not sky high rises, or skyscrapers, or whatever you want to call it, and stuff like that. So it's just like it just reminds me of somebody going like, you know, wow, you know, it's like these newfangled 8-track things are just so different from listening to stuff on vinyl. And you know, it's out, even though vinyl's making a comeback. So I guess this is a really horrible example, but you know what I'm getting at. But he feels it's an insight into his character, I guess, because he feels that wood carries the character of things. It has a spirit unto itself, whereas brick doesn't.
So this is going to probably inform him as a person or as an investigator and in how he targets his suspects, maybe.
Possibly, yeah.
We also learn that because the property owner is asking if the Ripper is back, and the investigator basically says, no, this is not like the Ripper because there was a survivor during this particular incident. So you and I had a conversation about this already.
Yeah, okay, so there's two options, or three options, really. The first option being they think the survivor is actually Ethan because he was lying down and he had blood on him. He passed out, he blacked out. And if he gets up, you know, the astute investigator is going to be able to tell that there was a body lying in a certain spot and there was blood there. So they think that maybe somebody who survived the attack got up and walked away.
Right.
The second one being
Somebody crouched away.
somebody crouched away hiding and just missed the melee and then, you know, ran away. And the third one was your idea, so I'll let you hit it.
I don't remember seeing the Native American, and so I'm thinking maybe he is not fully human because why would Ethan's father send two humans to bring him back?
That's a really good point. You know, Ethan's dad has to know because, I mean, we've all seen Teen Wolf, so we know that this is passed on hereditarily. So it's not something that just springs up. And well, no, unless you go by the American Werewolf in London theory, which it's a bite, right?
I don't know. I haven't seen that.
Well, why haven't we rectified this yet?
We will.
Okay, if I believe it's a bite. I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but Ethan is still an American Werewolf in London. So there
But
we've got.
so it would be interesting if they're gonna, play around with these ideas of these various supernatural entities and maybe the Native American. If he's a survivor, he could have been there and I just overlooked. Maybe he's a Wendigo.
That would be awesome, just to add
Yes.
another element to it.
Yeah, why not? Okay, so we're just throwing that out there and see if it sticks.
Well, it could be building up to where every character has their own nemesis,
Yeah.
rather than all of them fighting one big bad, you know, like the Avengers at the end of the series or something like that, fighting an Ultron or a Thanos or something like that. They each have their personal nemesis that they have to vanquish. But anyway.
They all have their own past that's coming back to haunt them,
Yeah.
which we know is happening with Ives.
Such sins at my back that it would kill me to turn around, something like that.
That's what Ethan said last season. Okay, so now we're back with Ives. She paces her room smoking. She's waiting for Malcolm to come home. I actually think he's the only one who can give her any modicum of comfort. Ethan, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I totally agree with what you're saying. He's the daddy. You know, I mean, he's the father of this whole group.
Yeah.
You know, when Ethan left the day before, he said, I'll come back tomorrow when Malcolm's here, when Dad's here to sort things out. You know what I mean? And I'll talk to him. She's pacing back and forth, waiting for him to get here. You know, I mean, like, as impressive and intimidating as Simbeni is, he works for Malcolm. So, and I think it's more of an employer-employee relationship, or more than an employer-employee relationship, obviously. So, Malcolm's a man, you know?
So Ethan questions Senbene downstairs about Ives' recent actions, and Senbene lets him know that she has not left her room all day long. And Ethan comments how he has never seen her frightened before.
Yeah.
They've only known each other a short time, but they have gone through some serious shit. So it is a valid remark. Because I thought, well, you really haven't really known her very long. So can you really say something? I've never seen her frightened before.
But if he's seen her go through what she's gone through and he didn't, his assessment of her wasn't that she was frightened and now she is, what the hell is going on? You know, what is she up against?
So Frankenstein is now working at his desk in his lab when he thinks he hears something from Brona's tank. He walks to her and sees she is still inanimate. He then begins to talk to her inanimate body and says, what will she make of this life? He says he will miss talking to her. Who will she be? And then he begins to touch her, first touching her scar on her chest and then over to her breast. He begins to caress down the length of her torso when he is interrupted by a knock at his apartment door. It is Sembenet who has summoned him to the Murrays.
So are we going to talk about the elephant in the room here and Victor being a little bit creepy with this?
Yes, we are going to talk about this.
Should you go first or should I go first?
Well, I just feel bad because he needs to get laid.
He's a virgin, you know? He has no experience with women whatsoever. This is probably the first breast that he's ever touched in that manner, besides cadavers and maybe doing some surgery, you know, but caressing in a sexual manner is something alien to him, poor guy. You know, so I'm not trying to advocate or make excuses for his actions by saying this. I'm just saying that somebody who has gotten to that age and hasn't gotten any play yet, it's probably going to occur to him at some time to be like, who are you? What are you going to be? And what does this feel like? So,
well, he's definitely starting to move his hand down further.
If Sembenet hadn't
knocked,
who knows?
Mm-hmm. Caliban arrives to meet his prospective new employer's family. Okay, so he meets Mrs. Putney. She's not very kind.
No.
And she gives him the dreary details of the job. He gives her a false name, John Clare, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she has him sign the book. He is then introduced to Lavinia. She is a young, pretty blind girl. She wants to touch his face so she can truly meet him. Caliban is so afraid of what her reaction might be, but she is not scared off by his scars.
She doesn't even comment on him. She just says, nice to meet you, Mr. Clare.
She responds with grace and tells him that it is good to meet him. Lavinia takes Caliban off to show him around, and Mrs. Putney is doubtful about Caliban's face, and Mr. Putney tells her, quiet woman, that face will make our fortune.
So we get a little bit of a reveal on Mr. Putney's character here. He's a bit of a jerk. You know, he obviously is, because he makes it seem like when Caliban is first talking to him, he's like, oh, you got to talk to the wife because she holds purse strings and she makes the decisions. And then he just flips the script right away and he's like, shut up, bitch. You know, we're going to hire this guy because he's going to make us rich. That face is going to make us rich. So there's something untoward going on here. And,
Because the way she reacts when he says that, it's almost like a slap in the face. So I think she's learned to
not get the actual slap in the face by just being quiet.
Basically.
Yeah.
Which is because, like, when you first meet him, he's got one of those really kindly faces with the crinkly eyes when he smiles and everything. And
like he could be a Santa Claus, you know, if you put on the beard and, you know.
Yeah. And then, like you said, flip the script and he's being jerk, but
who knows how this storyline is going to play out. But I mean, just like you can't get on the bad side of Vanessa Ives and really live to tell the story of it, you probably can't do the same thing with Caliban. Here's my theory. I think since Lavinia is blind, she's going to see him for the soul that he does have, the good soul that he does have.
Yes.
Even though he's done terrible things, I think he has a good soul. And he's going to bring her an orange and everything's going to be cool. But and then the way it's going to play out with Brona is that she's going to be attracted to Victor because she's going to see him as a creator and, you know, life giver and things like that. And she's not going to remember her past life, but she might remember a little bit of it at some point. And Ethan is going to see her because all these people are traveling in way too close of circles to each other to not have this happen. I mean, they haven't met Caliban yet, so I guess it's feasible that he could keep some secrets, but I'm sure Caliban's going to interact with the rest of the gang at some point.
I would like to see Lavinia touch Dorian Gray's face.
Oh.
And see what happens. Just out of curiosity.
Yeah. Huh. I bet you she won't like it.
I'm just curious to see how they would play that.
You're an ugly man, Mr. Gray.
We did not see this episode. Okay. So now Malcolm finally arrives home, which draws Ives out of her protective shell into his arms as he walks into the front door. Dr. Frankenstein checks Ives' health while Ethan and Ives tell them of the women they encountered the other night. Ives says these are not the creatures they faced before. Dr. Frankenstein tells her to rest. Ives tells them that the language the woman spoke was the Verbis Diablo, language of the devil. Dr. Frankenstein and Ethan have heard of this language, and they give us some background. Dr. Frankenstein does not believe that they were really speaking this mythical language. He feels it's impossible because it doesn't really exist, hence the word mythical. Ethan says, no, it's a dead language.
Like, difference.
Yes.
Big difference.
Yes. And then Ives tells Malcolm that she was not consciously speaking the Verbis Diablo when she spoke to the witch. Ives begins to say that she must face them alone, while Malcolm insists that they can help her because they have defeated creatures of the night before. Sembene confronts Ives about who they really are. He gets straight to it. He's like, just tell us. Cut the bullshit. Who are these bitches?
I like the fact that he wasn't cryptic. Like, yeah. I think in a lesser writer's hands, he would have been a cryptic character and said, blah, 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 blah. Something that just didn't really add to anything, but said,
blah, blah,
okay,
blah,
well, this
cryptic.
This person in the room hasn't said anything yet, so we have to give them a line. But Sembene cut right to it, and he's like, give it up. Who are they? Why do you know them?
And that's when she says, they are nightcomers, witches.
Now, you're going to hate me for doing this, but I'm going to digress just a tiny bit and bring up The Exorcist. Remember the part when Kinderman is talking to Father Karras, and he's talking about the paper that Karras wrote about demonology, basically, from the psychological aspect?
Yeah.
And he says that Bert Denning's head was found turned completely around in the same fashion that demons would kill witches. They would crack their necks and turn their heads completely around. So there is some sort of antithesis between, or that's not the right word maybe I'm looking for, some sort of antagonism between demons and witches, or at least between different demons, I would guess. So, but I don't know if all lore is on the same level, you know, depending on where you choose from. Witches could be disciples of demons, which that kind of seems like.
And they failed the demon, and then they end up having their heads twisted around.
Okay, yeah, we could look at it that way. Yeah, all right, that might be, because that wasn't included in the.
So think of the Forsaken and the Black Aja. I always bring up Wheel of Time, but.
So basically, the demon's in control. The witch is their proxy on Earth, and if they don't act in a way that's satisfactory, they get lumps.
Yeah, they get fucked up.
Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah. But so that would explain why. The antagonism exists because you're not doing what I tell you to do.
Right, you're failing.
Okay, all right. Now it all makes sense.
Speaking of the devil, our next subject, Evelyn Poole, is taking a relaxing blood bath, a la Countess Bathory. So maybe she's reinvigorating her youth with virgin blood or something.
Yeah, and there's a dead, well, I guess if we're assuming they're virgins, there's a dead virgin right by the pool.
She needed more than one virgin to fill that bath.
Yeah, but they only have that one body letting you know that this is fresh blood, I guess.
So she eventually leaves this bath, and she meets with her coven that waits for her in this sitting room of sorts that has all the skulls and the mementos of death that she talks about later. But Evelyn is disappointed in the three who confronted Ives the night before, and her daughter is named Hecate, and she's there. She was not one of the three. And Hecate says how she sees or saw that Ives has a protector, and he's a Lupus Dei, which is a wolf of God. And I have some information.
Ooh, some research.
Well, okay, so the Lupus Dei are wolves of God, and they are meant to fight evil, specifically witches.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. They are also able to travel to hell and fight hell beings there, apparently. But you can look them up online. I'm actually going to leave some links up that I came across and were actually sent to us by another listener, but there's an episode later that's called "In Hell Itself, My Only Foe." So that's kind of got me excited, knowing that he's a Lupus Dei, who can apparently travel to hell. Just it doesn't mean it's going to happen, but that's interesting.
With Hell Itself, My Only Foe, as a Penny Dreadful episode, that's a really, really good name. But it sounds like a shitty metalcore band too. But whatever.
So anything you want to say about Lupus Dei before I move on to finish
this
scene?
No, this whole Lupus Dei thing is new to me. I've never heard of it before, but it's a really intriguing idea.
Yeah, it's my first. I almost didn't look it up because I thought she was just saying werewolf.
Lupus.
Werewolf. So, okay. Hecate And Evelyn, even though they're mother and daughter, supposedly, I'm not sure if it's by blood, but they call each other that, and they have this really weird kinky relationship.
I'm guessing that...
And I think it's because they're witches and they get, like, passionate about their demons.
Possibly. I don't think she's actually her mother. I think this is a master-disciple type relationship, and they call her mother as an honorific. That's what I
think.
Did
the other ones call her mother? Because I don't think they did. She's definitely got favor. Hecate does.
Well, maybe she's kind of like the first, you know what I mean? Like she's the chosen one out of all of them, and these are just like she's the real disciple, and these are like alkalites or something. I don't know, but I got that's the impression that I got. I didn't get the impression that they were actual flesh and blood mother and daughter. I could be well wrong about that though.
Since Hecate revealed that the Ives has a Lupus Dei protecting her, mm-hmm. Evelyn sees that things are more complicated, that they have to, you know, apply more stratagems, and she says, okay, the Lupus Dei is yours. I'm going to get to Ives through Malcolm Murray. Mm-hmm. We have this other witch who interrupts their freaky getting on that's about to happen and apologizes for her failure with Ives. And she's the one who spoke the Verbis Diablo first to Ives, and then when Ives spoke it back. And so this is where she says Ives can speak the language, but she doesn't remember what Ives said to her, and this is where
she gets flipped.
His sentence, yeah, and she gets her neck sliced open.
With a pretty badass little ring.
Yeah, which is comes in handy because she uses it again later at the end of the episode.
What does she do at the end of the episode?
She cuts herself so she can draw that upside down cross on her forehead.
That's right. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so anything else you want to say about, like, the relationship among this coven is really competitive.
Yeah, I feel like I said, like, those three are kind of like junior alkalite type things, and this one really disappointed the mother by not being able to remember what was said. And she's like, well, did she mumble? No, she didn't mumble. I just didn't understand it all. Okay, well, then the fault is yours. You're dead. You know, and she had explained, she went through this whole big thing about explaining what Memento Mori was, mm-hmm. and about the Romans and things like that. And that's what that whole room was, you know, just like monuments to the dead. And
think her skull is going to be added to the collection?
Ah, it's possible. But I just wanted to add that house that she lives in is amazing.
Yeah.
I would live there, but that's just me.
It's a very typical Victorian witch style house.
Yeah, I would want baths of water, but that's just me.
So Hecate, like we've already stated, she's got some importance in this group. And because when the other two are commanded to take the body out, they cower away from Hecate.
And there's also this weird, like, bloodlust that goes on, because whenever the one girl's throat is cut and she starts spurting the blood, the other ones kind of do this, like, hissing sound. It was just Hecate?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it's an involuntary reaction to seeing the blood like that and just...
Yeah, it could be. And it also, I mean, they seem really competitive, too. So now Malcolm and Ethan discuss Ives. Ethan says he was intending to leave London, but now he will stay. And he's going to stay at the Murray Estate.
He doesn't ask permission. He basically just lays down the law and says, I'm going to stay here. You have a guest room, right? And
yeah.
Murray's like, oh, yeah, you stay here. Yeah, okay, sure.
Lightning storm rages outside, and Dr. Frankenstein runs to his apartment. And there's all these people just – I know it was like that before.
Yeah.
And last season, it just illustrates the poverty of that time. It's just crazy. So in Dr. Frankenstein's lab, Caliban is already there, and he's an able helper for Dr. Frankenstein as they get Brona to receive the lightning for her life ignition.
He is an eager beaver.
That's what he's hoping she'll be. So they hoist a copper antenna-looking contraption through the roof. Caliban is begging, please, 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 over Brona, and Dr. Frankenstein has to tell him to get back. Everything is set, and they wait, and Caliban begins to beg the sky to let her live. Dr. Frankenstein joins in with the yelling, and they are granted their wish. Lightning strikes and surges through all the mechanics. Steam rises above Brona's tank, and her hand reaches out to grasp the lip. She stands naked before them.
Now, when the lightning was coming down and everything was starting to electrify, and you've got Frankenstein running around and flipping all these switches and pulling everything down, it looked like he was working the controls in a TARDIS.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, then Rose Tyler gets up, and
no kidding.
She's standing there naked. One of the things about like we're big Doctor Who fans, so we've seen all the new ones. And Billie Piper just doesn't seem to age. She has that like baby face no matter how old she gets. Because, I mean, we've probably seen like a good decade worth of her acting career at this point. And she doesn't look any older than she did the first time that, you know, we saw her on Doctor Who. It's crazy.
So, anything you want to say about this scene?
Yeah, she's going to be a lot different than anybody expects. I think she's going to be the true wild card of this season.
That was a tough job, I think, for Billie Piper to be naked through most of this episode.
Yeah, like, I mean, she doesn't have a speaking part at all.
Well, also, I mean, also being laying down and have cameras coming from various angles, you know.
That are sometimes unflattering.
She never looked bad to me. But, I mean, but if I was laying, you know, down on something like that, I would just be like, wondering, you know what I mean? It would just be that's a lot of, you know, courage. And I think no matter what your body type is, you would worry about that.
So. Yeah, dedication to your role to just be able to put that kind of trust in. Because all she did effectively was to lay down and then stand both times naked throughout this whole episode. That was it.
She has some great hand acting, though, because when her hand came up out of the, the tank, it looked cool. She must have practiced that.
Yeah. All the time between cuts and everything. Yeah. She's just like,
Give me something to do while I'm just laying here freezing. I thought it was a bit overdramatic with all the yelling.
Yeah,
that's just me.
The first time I saw it, I was wondering why Frankenstein was yelling as well. I know why Caliban is yelling, but I was kind of wondering why Victor was yelling. But then the second time I watched it, I was still kind of wondering, but I felt like it played a little bit better because he's just wrapped up in the moment. He's ecstatic. He's exuberant. I mean, after all, this is his project. This is what he loves to do, you know, so he lives for this kind of experimentation and playing God and creator and stuff like that. And he's smart enough to do it. And it's the feeling that he must get, the satisfaction he must get to see something like that come to fruition and bring another body to life. I just imagine that he's caught up in the moment. He's just like, yeah.
I mean, and this is you've already said, it's his main endeavor.
Yeah.
Is to do this. And then he can make up for Proteus and Caliban. Hopefully have a better.
Hopefully, yeah. Like wipe the slate clean and be like, all right.
But you shouldn't start by fondling their naked bodies. It's just not a good start.
Usually, yeah. Yeah, usually not.
So now to our last scene. Ives stands in her darkened room before her cross. She turns and she sees Ethan down the hall. They look at each other in a way that's like, it's almost like, you can come in my room if you want. She's looking at him like, yeah, you're welcome if you want. Come on in. And he turns away and walks into his room.
Do you really think it was that, though?
I do.
Because whenever she got with Dorian Gray, that's when things turned really south of heaven on everybody in last season.
You're right, but that's just what the look looked like to me.
That's the look. That's the look.
So she ends up, since he turns away, she closes her door. She grabs two candles and then she kneels before her cross. She cuts her thumb and begins to render something out of her blood onto the floor. And it's a scorpion. Is this her sigil? I'm wondering. She begins to pray fervently as we have seen her do before. So then we cut to Evelyn Poole, who is now almost prostrate on the floor, and she's cutting herself, and she smears an upside-down cross onto her forehead. She begins to pray to her god, the devil, in a language we understand, which is in English, saying she will not fail to give him Ives. She then begins to speak in some other language, which I think is the Verbis Diablo, and she sounds crazy. And their three witches appear briefly behind Ives and vanish, and they appear again closer, and then they vanish again. Ives was aware of them there, and she seems frightened, and she cowers, and it's the end of episode.
Whatever they must represent is just got to be crazy for her to be that scared of them, but to have overcome everything that we've seen her overcome before.
We're just going to have to learn more about her past.
Yeah. That means there's going to be some cool flashback episodes, because those were some of the real fun ones last time. Remember the one with the that goes basically the only flashback episode, because it talks, well, not the only one. There was a couple of flashback episodes, but the one where she's put in that asylum and she's talking to the doctor and she's telling the doctor stuff about, you know, all those people who died. And he's like, what the hell? I mean, she really captured the scariness of somebody who's possessed. I will say this. If Vanessa Ives was giving Ethan the bedroom eyes, and he does really care about her. He's playing the long game. He's like, yeah, I want to do that too, but let's wait. Let's wait until we solve this problem that's right in front of us now, because I'm not going to take advantage of you while you're vulnerable. So good for him.
Oh, I forgot to mention that the song that Evelyn Poole is singing is called The Unquiet Grave. It's a traditional song. And that's actually one of the reasons why I'm wondering if there's history between Ives. What was I thinking at the time? Like, because she's saying, when will we meet again, sweetheart? When will we meet again? When the autumn leaves that fall from the trees are green and spring up again. Because that was the specific.
So you think they have a past?
Somewhere, someone does in that connection, yeah.
But they didn't recognize each other at the seance. They didn't come up to each other and be like, hey,
no,
it's you.
No.
So maybe in a different form or something?
Yeah, maybe. And maybe, I don't know.
We'll see.
What's the reason for her blood baths? Does it help her change her appearance, or does it, I mean, I don't know.
It's not for hygiene.
No. But they've somehow have had dealings with each other before. Another thing I wanted to mention, because Caliban was going to make 15 shillings. 1 shilling is 12 pennies.
Hmm.
To get 1 pound, you need 20 shillings.
So he's going to make that a day or a week?
A week.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're going to get into feedback. And so first we're going to read from Sarah Duncan Powers. And she says, woohoo! A new season of Penny Dreadful! Mrs. Murray was so harsh with Malcolm, but I don't blame her. All these years, he's been running off with women and the world, and now he thinks he can say the right words and wash it away? No, sir. I don't feel bad for him, because he wasn't being truthful with himself or with her anyway. His new family is at home with the Dreadfuls. Although Victor's emotional involvement with the group is not as strong, seeing as how he's perving over Brona's still dead body. Gross.
I knew this was going to come up at some point.
I've seen a few people look hopefully toward Caliban's storyline and believe something happy can develop with Lavinia, but I don't think that's possible. He is a violent creature born of death, and while the historical Lavinia had a good life, her Shakespearean counterpart in Titus Andronicus met a horrific end, rape, mutilation, and death. Do you remember that movie, Titus, you and I watched?
I did, with Anthony Hopkins.
Yes, Julie Taymor movie, and mm-hmm. You remember the girl that had the branches?
Yeah.
Her hands at the end? That's Lavinia.
Well, I think Dunkin' Donuts is wrong, and I think that Caliban is going to bring Lavinia oranges, and everybody's going to live happily ever after, so there.
So my strongest interest, though, is in the Lupus Day reveal. I found several really interesting links on Hounds of God, and I will share those links on our Facebook page if anybody's interested. I was originally thinking Ethan was just a werewolf who had turned to religion to purge his guilt, but a Lupus Day would be so much more. They are creatures sent back to Earth to enter Hell or the Demimonde and battle witches and demons. This would make him like a werewolf Constantine, which would be super cool. Here are my questions. Remember when Vanessa first found Ethan and said that by her accounts he would have been a little boy at the time of the massacre he was recreating and that there were no survivors? Do you think that he was present, died, and is much older than he appears? Does the father storyline counter that thought, or is his lack of aging a secondary reason why he can't go home? Could it be that it isn't even his father, but his maker? Maybe I've watched too much True Blood, but that pinged all kinds of possibilities for me, and I'm excited to see where this story goes. I'm loving that Penny Dreadful has dug up a werewolf variation that makes Ethan a much more valuable team member than we originally considered. Plus, that look between him and Vanessa towards the end. So good. Can't wait to hear the podcast. And she signed it Dunkin' Donuts.
That's right.
Yes, I really like what you're asking about Ethan and his past. I also like... The thing I thought about with the Lupus Day that I forgot to mention in the recap is that it explains how he was able to whip out. Was he wearing a St. Christopher necklace?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, speak Latin and deal with Vanessa the way he did when she was possessed.
Oh, okay. I didn't even think of that. That makes sense now. That's a perfect explanation for that.
Because we sat here and pondered over that. Like, what is it in his past that would make him capable of doing that?
We racked our brains for that. Like, yeah. did you read it in a book? I mean, they don't teach that in Sunday school.
But it is a good question to ask about the nature of his father, if it's really his biological father or is this his maker?
Hmm.
And yes, and then asking, and I didn't even think of, I just took it at face value that maybe he was being, he was lying about his origins when he first met Vanessa as a way to just cover up, you know, what he was hiding from himself.
Yeah.
The fact that he's running from his dad and just to, you know, cover his tracks.
It's interesting to me that somebody who would be involved in something like Lupus Day, which you would be protecting innocent people, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Because if you're killing these, you know, Satan's minions and stuff like that and going to hell to do it, you're obviously not fighting for the bad guy team. But your chosen profession is a gunslinging killer. So it's a cool juxtaposition. I wonder what the psychology is behind that.
All right. So we have another feedback from Decodies. I'm just going to read sections of it. So, Decody says, I totally am into Vanessa Ives. She is seriously vexed and vivacious and at times virile. Given Vikings is a whole year away, Vanessa is my new warrior princess. It would be so awesome if you could interview her. I have questions.
Holy shit. That would be awesome.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen.
Mary Moon was doable. I don't know if Vanessa Ives is doable.
And Amy Bailey started following us on Twitter. She's the only actor who's followed us on Twitter.
Yeah. So we kind of knew she might be game.
Yeah. That's how we were able to access her. It's not.
Yeah. But Ives is a different creature altogether.
So she said, so to add to my enjoyment during some routine task, I re-listened to all of your Penny Dreadful casts this week. It was good to hear what I said last year so I don't repeat. I even laughed at my bro ho ho comment about Ethan and Dorian. And unlike Paul, I still don't think Ethan did the first killing in episode one, but mostly because it seemed like it was the second floor and involved a little girl. She says, I saw those killings as the witches that came in on fresh hell practice runs. So she's thinking, it sounds like, the witches are involved in those killings.
Huh.
So for Ethan's murders, it did seem like he had a flashback of that hooker under the street lamp, but that was also in the presence of Dorian Gray. But I'm still unclear of who is killing who. I have some thoughts, but again, very fresh and not really formed. One of the several pondering questions I had was in Fresh Hell. I understood Madame Collie's goal, but not in relationship to helping the master. Can't a master get what he wants over a mere witch? Is it to twist Vanessa to evil because she's not evil? If Collie hurts Vanessa, how does that help the master unless Vanessa is his arch enemy and not his mate? Like you guys mentioned in the season one cast, I do think Mr. Murray is Vanessa's dad. My favorite actor character is Eva Green, Vanessa. My favorite relationship is Vanessa and Ethan's. My curiosity is still high on Sebene and how he and Mr. Murray came to be, so that may be a second favorite relationship if it develops. I'm interested in Dorian Gray. Like Steve, I liked him initially, and more with each episode, and the visual made him more appealing. Pretty boys aren't my style, but I find they have an intensity or flavor that intrigues me. I totally held on the same word Steve did with Dorian uses of flowers being duplicity. One of my friends reads a lot of Victorian fiction and nonfiction. When I brought this up, she said that high society, royals, and Victorian theater had a heavy duplicitous nature, so she didn't see that label as strange instead of very telling for a Dorian comment. Anyway, of all characters to bring that word up, I thought interesting. I agree with M that Dorian is very honest, but also not the most revealing. Does that make sense? I did want to ask M, should I or shouldn't listen to the 9 free podcasts from BJ Harrison on the story of Dorian Gray? Will it be too revealing if I listen? Well, I mean, it depends if you want to know how his demise, if you want to know about that. So
I always go back to, I know I wasn't asked, but I always go back to the whole thing about when it comes to historical stuff, and this is already fiction that's referencing other fiction. So it gets kind of dicey. But the writers are kind of doing this buffet style. They're picking and choosing what they want to do. So if you listen to a podcast like that, you're going to find out what happened in the actual story of Dorian Gray, the picture of Dorian Gray.
Right.
But you're not necessarily going to get insight into what's going to happen with the character of Dorian Gray on Penny Dreadful.
Right.
So, but you never know. I mean, it could color your vision, or it definitely will to a certain extent, because you're going to be watching it thinking, all right, well, this is supposed to happen or that's supposed to happen. You're kind of waiting for moments that may or may never come.
Well, I can tell you it hasn't taken from my enjoyment because I have read the book. So,
yeah, there you go.
I'm just curious as how it's all going to play out. That's what I feel and think when I see him.
I'm trying to remember what I said about Dorian Gray when we first saw him.
I remember you didn't.
I think
because you first saw him when both Ives and him like see each other, and it was like this magnetism, and it was like the
Tractor beam. Suck
yeah.
me
And
right
you didn't,
in.
I think you thought it was too much talking or too wordy, or he was coming on to, laying it on too thick at first.
Right, but then you get to know his character, and that's just how he is, and then you start to like him. So I disliked him in the first episode that I saw him in, or not disliked him per se, but I was a little bit wary because I just felt like there were certain things about his characterization that were off-putting, but then it grew on you.
And so, yeah, and she gave us a link to another version of the Unquiet Grave also. But thanks to Cody. Thank you for writing in to us once again.
Yeah, thanks. All right, I'd just like to thank Wile E. Coyote and Dunkin' Donuts for writing us. I think it's really cool you guys take the time out, to listen to our podcast in the first place, but then to take the time out of your day to write us and give us your comments and stuff like that. It's super awesome. And
It's cool to be talking Penny Dreadful again.
yes, it is. I missed this show. I didn't realize how much I missed it until Em played the intro music that she picked out for it. For the podcast, and she just played a couple of minutes of one of our season one episodes, and I was like, oh man, and it just brought back all these memories. And so, I miss Vikings just as much as anybody else, as I'm sure you two guys do, and some of our listeners who also listen to the Vikings podcast do as well. But it's kind of like a bittersweet thing because I know when that's over, you get to do Penny Dreadful, which
Right.
is a show that, as much as I love Vikings, this show is really up my alley. And thank you two for writing in. Keep it up, please.
Thank you. And all right, so that's it. Next episode we'll be discussing is going to be called The Nightcomers. Nope.
Nope, 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 nope,
It's going to be called
nope,
Verbis
nope.
Diablo.
Ooh, Verbis Diablo.
Yes. All right, so until next time, I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. We are bound on a wheel of pain.
V and me. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.